Welcome to The Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Brooke Verlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays, read by Leighton Pugh.
Nationality, its persistence and significance. Stephen Grosby. The advance of modern communications, global trade of goods and services, and an increasingly international division of labour have led some to predict that nations are becoming obsolete. However, contrary to those predictions, nations continue to exist. To understand why, requires recognition of their anthropological, historical, and political significance. The specific problems posed by their continued existence are to understand the nation as a cultural community of territorial kinship, the patriotic attachment to the national state, and nationalism as a political ideology. To be sure, humanity has throughout history organized itself in numerous ways. There have been clans, tribes, and tribal leagues. There have been city-states and alliances of city-states. And there have been states that have encompassed different nations. Humanity has also organized itself into national states and empires as oppositional alternatives. This opposition is found across civilizations and throughout history. One finds it in the ancient Near East, in Israel's opposition to the Egyptian, Assyrian, Babylonian, and Seleucid empires, as described in the Bible. The biblical Hebrew term goy is translated as nation. And in the Jewish war against Imperial Rome, as recounted in Josephus's history, Bellum Judaicum. The alternative of nation or empire can also be seen in the 16th century, in Shia Safavid Iran's opposition to the Sunni Ottoman Empire. This was a continuation of a long-developing distinctive national Persian self-awareness in contrast to the Arabs, a contrast that may be observed in such earlier works as the 11th century Shahnameh, the Persian Book of Kings, by Abul Qasem Fardosi. One observes it in Korea's opposition to China, in the fourth of the Ten Injunctions of the Korean King Taejo, 943 AD. In the past, we have always had a deep attachment for the ways of China, but our country occupies a different geographical location, and our people's character is different from that of the Chinese. And of course, we see it in Europe. For example, during the 16th century in the Dutch nation's opposition to the Spanish Empire. These and many other examples indicate that nationality is not exclusively European in origin, nor did it arise only in the modern period in the aftermath of the 1648 Treaty of Westphalia, as some scholars claim. The questions before us are, what is a nation? What is its significance? And to what problems of life is its persistence a response? In pursuing the answers, we should never lose sight of what should be their focus. Why is a nation important to an individual member of the nation? Why have individuals been willing to sacrifice their lives for what they understand to be their nation? What accounts for the conviction and intensity of the attachment that the individual has for what the individual understands to be his or her nation? Let us thus begin with the individual. What is an individual? What is the awareness that the individual has of himself or herself? What indeed is the self? Classical liberalism's answer to these questions is in many ways admirable. Its focus on the freedom of the individual to pursue opportunities, personal responsibility, the free market, and the rule of law represent hard-won achievements of our civilization. These achievements deserve our defense. However, as the distinguished economist Frank Knight observed in his 1939 article, Ethics and Economic Reform, classical liberalism also erred in taking the individual as a given, as if the individual were a self-enclosed entity. By doing so, it simplified the individual by assuming an impoverished view of the mind, often confining its workings to some kind of utilitarian calculation of comparable interests, and minimized, or even ignored, the importance to the individual of ideals such as friendship, altruism, beauty, or salvation. The individual comes into the world destitute and helpless, dependent on groups for his or her existence and development. I do not wish this observation about this dependency and helplessness to be misunderstood. After all, the givenness of the individual is indisputable. All languages have the first-person singular, I. The individual thinks. The individual experiences pain and pleasure. And, importantly, one poses questions to oneself about how one should act. However, if you ask yourself who you are, you include in that self-description references to groups, for example, your family, church, and nation. These components of the self are also indisputable. After all, languages also have the first-person plural, we. The groups that make up we are not only associations that one voluntarily joins and leaves. Not all relations are contractual. As was noted, some relations constitute part of the individual's understanding of the self, as the individual's existence has been dependent upon them and remains intertwined with them. One understands oneself to be a part of these groups, and they are a part of oneself. This remains as true today as it was in the more tradition-bound past. That these relations contribute to how one understands oneself goes some way in accounting for the persistence and significance of one of them, the nation, the land in which one is born and in which one is raised, the language one speaks, and the culture which contributes to how one understands one's place in the world and in the universe. The pride one has for that national culture is patriotism. Is it thus so surprising that when one thinks that one's nation, its life-sustaining territory and culture are threatened, one becomes defensive? When that defensiveness becomes fanatical, dividing mankind into two warring camps, the forces of light versus the forces of darkness, we have the ideology of nationalism. This conceptual distinction between patriotism and nationalism is justifiable and necessary, for one can have pride in one's own country without hating another's country. It is also politically necessary if one wishes to have a decent civil society, so that the individual may navigate between his or her free pursuit of opportunities and the requirement to live peacefully both with other members of one's nation and with those of another nation, even when disagreements exist. Nevertheless, the patriotic attachment to what one understands to be the homeland of one's nation bears the potential to be warped into an uncivil ideological nationalism. There are too many historical examples that confirm this potential, for example, the German Kulturkampf of the 1870s, and in antiquity, according to Plutarch, Cato the Elder's unrelenting hatred of Carthage. Numerous factors can prevent patriotism from being warped into ideological nationalism. In his brief monograph, The Price of Liberty, 1937, the German sociologist and economist Adolf Loewe argued that the importance of gardening to the English was one reason why fascism was not possible in England. Religion, with its orientation to an existence that transcends the daily affairs and attachments of this world, is another factor. The significance of Loewe's point about gardening and my reference to religion, at least the monotheistic religions, is that they represent qualitatively different expressions of human attachment to the ideology of nationalism, which wrongly seeks to repress these different attachments out of an all-absorbing, hence ideological, devotion to only one putatively redemptive goal, the nation. I now turn to the nation. In doing so, I remind you that it is a mistake to draw a hard and fast distinction between individual and nation. Once again, the self-consciousness of the individual and the shared awareness of being related to others, as members of a nation, interpenetrate or overlap with one another. All human activities, including face-to-face encounters, occur between what has been and what might be, between tradition and departures from tradition. When, as we make choices, we stumble towards what might be, not only do previous accomplishments and failures provide a framework for those choices, but so also does our memory of those accomplishments and failures. Of course, these memories may not be accurate. In the study of nationality, the selective adaptation of memory in the formation of a culture was acknowledged as early as 1882 by the French polymath Ernest Renan. In his essay, What is a Nation?, he observed, "Forgetting, I would even say historical error, is an essential factor in the creation of a nation." The selective reception of the past, as a result of and in the service of the demands of the present, is the price paid by tradition to be a part of the life of the present. One example of this selective adaptation of the past to the present is the reception of the mythical image of the Israelite exodus from Egypt, with its repeated refrain, "Let my people go." In the history of ancient Israel, this memory likely provided a justification for the pursuit of independence of the nation from the Assyrian and Babylonian empires. This biblical image was also drawn upon as the Dutch, English, Italians, Czechs, and others appealed to the Israelite exodus in their own struggles for national independence. We see this in the paintings of the miraculous crossing of the Red Sea by the 16th century German artist Lucas Cranach, the 17th century Flemish painter Martin Poupain, and the Frenchman Nicolas Poussin and Charles Lebrun, and straddling the 18th and 19th centuries, the American-born Benjamin West and the Irishman Francis Danby. Many other events of national significance in ancient Israelite history were also appealed to in European culture. Jewish opposition to the Babylonian exile, as depicted by the chorus's lament, "Va pensiero sul ali dorate," in Verdi's 1841 opera Nabucco, likely conveyed the Italians' desire for their sovereignty and independence from, at that time, Austria. The Maccabee-led war for national independence against the Seleucid Empire, as portrayed by Handel's 1746 oratorio Judas Maccabeus, commemorated the victory of England's Maccabean army of the Duke of Cumberland against the Scottish Jacobite uprising at the Battle of Culloden. However historically paradoxical, those early modern European nations understood themselves to be new Israels. Some scholars argue that this kind of selective reception of tradition in support of the formation of a territorially extensive yet bounded nation suggests the invention of tradition of the nation as an imagined community. However, if we are content with merely observing the selective adaptation of tradition, we lose sight of something of considerable importance for understanding nationality. What is selectively received and thereby modified from the past is kept alive in and becomes a part of the present precisely because it is recognized to be significant. The important question is, what is that significance? What is remembered is not capricious. We must draw a distinction between acts of the imagination and the arbitrarily imaginary. It is the case that the existence and continuation through time of the territorially extensive yet bounded nation is dependent upon both an imaginative reception of the past into the present and the imaginative extension of what one thinks to be one's own to encompass a national territory and its people. So that the entire land becomes one's own home, its past becomes one's past, and those people of that past and current territory become one's people. This geographical extension into a relatively extensive yet bounded territorial homeland distinguishes the category of nation from that of clan, tribe, or city-state. Nonetheless, the nation is not a unicorn. The attachments to what one perceives to be one's homeland or the idea of the freedom of self-government in opposition to the tyranny of empire while dependent upon the imagination, are neither arbitrary nor fanciful. The image of one's home and the idea of the freedom to govern one's affairs in concert with those who share that image are important to the individual. Even though the images of one's homeland and the self of self-government involve acts of the imagination that are both necessary for the existence of a nation and important to the individual, those acts are often disputed. There are disagreements over how we understand the past, and they have a bearing on how we understand the present. Furthermore, those disagreements are often expressed as political differences. Nonetheless, one's home and the national self of self-government convey significance for individuals because they are understood to be life-sustaining and life-ordering. I remind you that we are interested in nationality because of the intensity and conviction of the attachments that the individual has to the image of the nation. If there is merit to these observations, a deeper anthropological perspective opens up before us. What problems of life does nationality address? As rightly stated in the outline for the 2017 Engelsberg seminar, the Latin noun natio, from the verb nasci, to be born from, is the root of our modern concept of nation. It implies that our birthplace is vital for our sense of belonging and identity. We are all born somewhere. The etymology of the word nation, to be born from, is an indication that the nation is a form of a social relation for the propagation and transmission of life, where recognition of birthplace remains vital for one's sense of belonging, self-understanding, and relation with others who understand themselves as sharing that birthplace. Thus, the nation is a form of kinship, albeit a territorial kinship. That we of the nation and that somewhere of its bounded territory indicate that the territory is understood to belong to that we, and the we belong to it. The nation is also a form for the order of life as expressed through custom, tradition, and law. Finally, the nation is a structure for the freedom of life, that is, self-government usually requiring a state, so that the nation not only exists as a cultural community, but also through the exercise of power, may act freely in the world to determine its own affairs. The relation between these three forms varies from one nation to another, from one civilization to another, and through time. The three forms come together as a unity, a national culture, but this coming together does not imply uniformity. Tensions exist between their components, as can be seen in disagreements within a nation over language policy, regional autonomy, religion, and the criteria for citizenship. The latter has recently received much attention in disagreements over immigration, about who is the we of the nation. In these disagreements, we observe tensions between the nation as a form of kinship, as a bearer and product of law, and when there is a national state, the freedom to act in the world. Thus, while it is legitimate to speak of a national culture, to do so does not mean that such a culture is homogeneous or stable. The social relation of the we of the nation is not fixed through time, as if it were made of stone. It is made up of living human beings who are continually evaluating, experimenting, and adapting to new challenges. What this means is that while a nation necessarily has its own history that shapes how it is understood by its members, the continuity through time posited by that history can only be relative, for the nation is also always in a process of changing. None of these previous comments was intended to convey that the mind of the individual is confined to the horizon of the nation. It surely isn't, as we know from the universal orientation of the world. Monotheistic religions, the international pursuit of scientific truth, and the economic relation of free trade. There are tensions between these universal orientations and nationality. The case for empire is the aspiration of humanity to universality, where there is legal uniformity throughout an extensive territory, resulting in peace within the empire, such as the Pax Romana of the Roman Empire, under Caracalla, 212 AD. Occasionally, there may have been empires that, once established, have cultivated toleration, for example, Cyrus's Persia. The Jews certainly viewed Cyrus favourably, referring to him as no less than the Messiah, Isaiah chapter 45, verse 1. However, even when such an empire exists, those outside the empire are viewed with suspicion, and often worse. Furthermore, we have too many examples of the imperialism of brutal empires, such as the Assyrian, where universal aspirations ran roughshod over local traditions. As a matter of fact, forced population transfers began not with the empires of the Nazi Reich and the Soviet Union, but with the Assyrian Empire of the 8th century BC. There remains merit to the Austrian-born American economist Joseph Schumpeter's definition of imperialism as the objectless disposition on the part of a state to unlimited forcible expansion. Above all, whatever may be attractive about the universality of empire, it develops at the expense of the freedom of self-government that is conveyed by the nation. We know, or at least we rightly assert, that as humans we are all equal, and yet we also know that as members of distinct nations we are not the same. Perhaps the most important problem posed by the continuing existence of nations is whether or not we are capable of holding simultaneously within our minds these two orientations that are in tension with one another.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolpe. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.